verses for February and March have been the great I am sayings found in John's Gospel. Now, I've listed these in the sermon notes. There are seven of them. We have one more to cover where Jesus says, I am the true vine. But this morning we're looking at the great I am statement found in John chapter 8. Now, this is very important because, as I've listed in the sermon notes, there are over two dozen references that Jesus makes of himself in John's Gospel in which he uses the word I am. And it's not difficult to see that this language reaches all the way back into the book of Exodus, in which Moses, when he inquired of God, when I go to the people of Israel and they ask me his name, what shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, tell them that I am. The Hebrew word can be translated, I will be what I will be, or I am that I am. But I'm inclined to think that the Septuagint, the Greek New Testament, the Greek Old Testament, captures rightly the force of the Hebrew when it translates that expression, I am that I am. And Jesus uses that language. So we're going to read this morning from two passages in John's Gospel. One found in John chapter 8, but then another found in John chapter 2, where we read of the first cleansing of the temple, because they are related, because of the hostility of the Jews at the time are manifested in these two events. John chapter 8. And they brought to the Pharisees, I'm looking at John chapter, John chapter 8, beginning with verse 31. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed in him, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And they answered him, we are Abraham's descendants, and have never yet been enslaved to anyone. How is it you say you will become free? Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits a sin is the slave of sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. So if the son make you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are Abraham's descendant, yet you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. I speak the things of which I have seen with my father. Therefore, you also do the things you have heard from your father. They answered him and said, Abraham is our father. Jesus said, if you are Abraham's children, do the deeds of Abraham. But as it is, you are seeking to kill me, a man who told you the truth, which I heard from God. This Abraham did not do. You are doing the deeds of your father. They said to him, we are not born of fornication. We have one father, God. Jesus said to them, if God were your father, you would love me. For I proceeded forth and have come from God, for I have not even come on my own initiative, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I am saying? It is because you cannot hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, for it comes from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convinceth me of sin? If I speak truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the words of God. For this reason, you do not hear him, because you are not of God. The Jews answered him and said, did we not rightly say that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? But Jesus answered, I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. But I do not seek my glory. There is one who seeks and judges. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. The Jews said to him, now we know for sure that you have a demon. Abraham died, and the prophets also, and you're saying, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste of death. Surely you're not greater than our father Abraham, who died. The prophets died too. To whom do you make yourself out to be? Jesus answered, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing, but it is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say, he is our God. And you have not come to know him, but I know him. And if I say that I did not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him and keep his word. Your father rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. So the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham? And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. And therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. If you'll turn over to John chapter 2, we're going to read of the cleansing of the temple, because the discourse I just read to you took place at the temple as well. And here in John chapter 2, beginning with verse 13, we read of this great event where Christ cleansed the temple for the first time. Now the Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables. And he made a scourge of cords, and he drove them out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. He poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling doves, he said, take these things away and stop making my father's house a place of business. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. Well then, there is in John's gospel not a chronological development of the life of Christ. He picks out events, he picks out certain aspects, and then he weaves these together in his gospel. He tells us at the end of John's gospel that Jesus did many other things, that if I took time to write them down, I couldn't do it. So he's selectively looking at certain things that he thematically wants to develop. And the I am statement in John 8 really goes all the way back to this event described in John chapter 2, where Jesus cleanses the temple. Notice how this is described. The Passover of the Jews was near. Now, people have taken umbrage with the fact that John's gospel uses the term Jews in a negative light. It's really not being used categorically to describe the Jewish people as such, as it is to describe the Jewish authorities and those who were in positions of leadership. And so here we have in the statement of the Passover of the Jews, to distinguish it from other religious ceremonies that the Samaritans had and the other people around the area had religious celebrations. So this is the celebration that the Jewish authorities oversaw. And so it is described as the Passover of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Josephus tells us that the population of Jerusalem at this time was approximately 40,000 to 50,000 people. At the time of the Passover, the population would swell 3 to 4 times that size so that you could have close to 1 million people. Now, at the center of this influx of people is the temple. And notice what is being described here. There are, in the court of the Gentiles, that is the outer court, if you had a map, an aerial view of the temple, you would see that there was the entryway in which it was called the court of the Gentiles, because Gentiles were allowed in here. And then it was restricted as you went further in, eventually to where only the great high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. But what had happened was the family of the high priest controlled the court of the Gentiles. And guess what they did? They set up a bazaar, kind of like a flea market. And there were all kinds of things that were taking place here. Now, just imagine the crowd. How many of you have been to something like the Texas State Fair?
Hi, Big Tex here.
And there's just thousands and thousands of people, you know. Well, multiply that times 10, and you get the chaotic hum of people. Now, what's taking place here? The Jews who traveled from around Palestine to this magnificent event were required to bring sacrifices. And guess what? It had to be inspected. See if there's a blemish on it. If you brought a sheep, the high priest had inspectors. And if they found anything wrong with it, you ain't using it. And there's a catch here. By the way, we just happen to have some that have been pre-approved. There's a fee for me to inspect that animal that you must pay, and then you find out your animal does not pass. Well, you still have to pay the fee. Now you have to go and buy one of theirs. Now, where you came from, you could buy your sheep for maybe 2.5 shekels. Now it's 10 times that price. How many of you have ever been up to Lake Roosevelt and go fishing? There is a gas station there. It's the only one for miles. And you'll find out that the gas prices are sometimes a dollar more than it is 15 miles away in Globe. Go in and buy a bag of ice. In Globe, you can buy a bag of ice for $1.25. Guess what you have to pay for that bag of ice up there? $5. Well, they can do it. Because where else are you going to get it? So here are these poor people. I've now got to pay a fee to find out that my sacrifice doesn't meet their standards, and now I have to go buy one at an exorbitant price. And the high priest's family gets a percentage of all the money. What else is going on here? The money changers. You see, there is a temple tax that was required of all males 19 years and older. It amounted to a day's labor pay. It was called a shekel. And the Jewish authorities wanted to make sure that they had an exchange. If you came from, say, down the road in Taurus, where Paul came from, and you brought coins, you couldn't just go in there and pay the temple tax with anybody's coin because it could have a pagan deity or Caesar on it. Those coins are not acceptable. And so you will have to pay to have your coins exchanged. And guess what? It's not like if you go to an arcade and you put a dollar bill and you get 4 quarters back. What would you do if you put a dollar bill in and it only gave you 2 quarters because it's going to charge you 2 quarters to use the machine? And so they would come in and find out that the coins that you cannot use here, but I tell you what, we will have you buy the shekel coin at 3 times the price so you can pay the proper tax. And all this money was being used to line the pockets of the high priest. Now here comes Jesus. Lowly Jesus is full of anger. He makes a whip. And he says, "You have turned my father's house into a den of thieves." In fact, the language actually refers to a pirate's cave. Can you imagine a pirate's cave where all kind of debauchery took place? Jesus is describing this holy atmosphere as a den of thieves. They are fleecing God's people. They're taking advantage. Jesus wasn't against commerce per se, but he was against this underhanded robbery that was taking place. And the poor Gentiles, this is where they're supposed to pray, and it's just all their chaos. So Jesus drives out the money changers, turns their money over, gets them out of there, and the people are taking notice now. Jesus now becomes a marked man because he refers to this. He is now Messiah of the temple. This is his temple. You're going to come into my house and treat it this way? No, you're not. And so he's indignant with them. He drives them out, and away they go. But they mark this down, and so as we go over to the 8th chapter, where Jesus has again incensed them by his healing ministry, the Jews, and again, the Jews there is referring to the Jewish authorities, begin to say, "By what authority are you doing this?" This goes all the way back to the cleansing of the temple. And Jesus gets into this exchange. He literally calls them children of the devil. Oh no, Abraham is our father. If you were Abraham's children, you would do the things that Abraham did, which is what? Believe me. And so Jesus claims prerogatives that only God can claim. And it culminates in this one. Before Abraham was born, and then he says it, I am. They understood all too clearly what he is saying. He is identifying himself with that same God who spoke to Moses. It is interesting that in the conversion of Saul of Damascus, you know, when he was on the road to Damascus, he was persecuting the church. He was taking Christians prisoner. He had authorities from, guess who? The Jewish authorities. Papers from them. And on the road to Damascus, he is suddenly struck down with a bright light. And he makes this statement. And you'd have to read in the Greek text to see it forcefully. Paul, or Saul, not yet called Paul, says, "Who are you, Lord?" And the New American Standard Bible translates it accurately. I am Jesus. But the I am is emphasized. And now Paul says, this is Yahweh. The one who I thought was this miserable peasant from Nazareth is the eternal God. He is Yahweh. I am. And so, I am has appeared to Saul of Tarsus. And this is the force of the language that we read in John chapter 8 as well. Now, what is the reaction of the crowd when they hear this? We know already that they were plotting to kill Jesus. They were just waiting for an opportune time to do it. And on this occasion, they decided, forget it. They pick up stones to stone him. They're going to kill him. And Jesus does a vanishing act. He just disappears. James Boyce, you know, the great pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church, makes this observation. The strange thing about this is its folly. This, we're going to kill Jesus by stoning him. Oh, by the way, Jesus was not going to die by stoning. He is going to die by crucifixion. For Jesus Christ cannot be so easily gotten rid of. If he is God, he is eternal. He is the Ancient of Days. How can one eliminate the Ancient of Days from one's days? He is the Lord of life. How can one exclude the Lord of life from one's life? Imagine trying to dislodge the Rock of Ages with a handful of stones. The Lord Jesus Christ is the Rock of Ages yet, and you will never get rid of him by throwing things at him. He is inescapable. He is planted in life. Thus, you must either come to terms with him now, or you must do so on the day of judgment. You have one or two choices. You may destroy yourself by pounding yourself against him, just as you can destroy a piece of wood by pounding upon it with an anvil, or you may build upon him. Why not build upon him? The Rock of Ages makes a great foundation. Jesus said that the one who builds upon him will be like a house founded upon a rock upon which the rains descended and the floods came, but which it failed not. Why not try him? Why not put him to the test? Jesus is able to save and deliver all who call on his name, because he is the great I Am.